So, good evening. First thing to do is to check you can hear me. You hear me in the back row there? Very good. Now, this is a paper written by three people. Montek Ahluwalia, who is here. Himanshu Gupta, who is not here. He's in California at Stanford. But he was in Niti Aayog, which is the successor to the Planning Commission, working with Montek when Montek was at the Planning Commission, and myself. Now, I'm going to chair it, but Montek is going to present it. We've benefited from help within the Grantham Institute here at the LSE, and Patrick Curran, who's here, was particularly instrumental in putting this into even better shape than it was before. It's a great pleasure, but it's also quite difficult for me to introduce Montek, because it's a pleasure and easy because I know a lot about him, but it's also difficult because I know a lot about him. But I will not mention all I know, which is almost entirely favourable, let it be said. But we met in 1970, so we've known each other for a very long time. We've been arguing ever since then, and sometimes, and even often, agreeing. And that was when he was at the World Bank. He was at Oxford, did an MPhil in economics, but then he was at the World Bank, where he stayed for 11 years, did some very famous work on inequality, but all sorts of other things as well. And then he went home, and from 1979 to 2001, he was a civil servant in the government of India, in the Prime Minister's office, the Commerce Ministry, and I think he's particularly well known for his service in the Finance Ministry, where he was at the head of the civil service, the Finance Secretary in the Finance Ministry, for the critical period of the economic reforms and the opening up and liberalisation in India during the 1990s. So when arguably the greatest country in the world on a number of key dimensions starts to change, and a few people are at the heart of that story, they've had a very big role in changing the world, and Montek has indeed had a very big role in changing the world. Inside all that is a basic academic that's always been trying to get out. So what you're seeing now is that academic emerging. But from the Finance Ministry, he became the first director of the Independent Valuation Office of the IMF, a critical unit that began self-examination in the institution that previously had probably not been particularly talented in self-examination. Much better now, much better, and in large measure as a result of the work of the Independent Evaluation Unit. And then he became, in 2004, and he was there for 10 years or so, the Deputy Chairman of the Planning Commission, which means the head of the Planning Commission, because formally the Prime Minister is always the Chair of the Planning Commission. And again, a very important 10 years in India's history. So that's Montek, and this is a story about how energy strategy can, and I think we're suggesting should change in India, and what India does has a profound influence, not only, of course, on the well over a billion people of India, but also the world. Montek, it's a great pleasure to have you back at the LSE, and I look forward, as everybody else does, very much to listening to you, and I hope we'll have a good period for interaction and questions at the end. Montek, please.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you. Thank you very much, Nick. It's great. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here. As you can see, this is a presentation on a paper jointly written with Nick and another colleague. In fact, the writing of the paper illustrates a little bit the phrase, the depth of distance, because Mr. Gupta was in Stanford, I was in Delhi, and Nick was in London, and we were sort of exchanging drafts and tables and calculations pretty seamlessly through email. And then Patrick got added to that and made some very critical calculations for us at the last minute, and I just met him for the first time 3 minutes ago. So that says something about technology. I won't go on and on. Let me go straight to the paper, because I would like to leave enough time for questions. Roughly, this is what I'm going to do. Little background, then describe two scenarios for India, point out the implications for the emissions and also the energy security consequences, look at the investments and the costs of transiting from the business as usual scenario to the low carbon scenario, and then talk about policy. As far as background is concerned, I mean, the obvious starting point is the Committee of Parties meeting, the COP21 meeting in Paris. It'd been widely described as a major step forward, et cetera, and it was an important advance, but it's only a step. The good news is that for the first time, all the developing countries agreed to do something. I mean, these negotiations were stuck for years because developing countries basically said, look, you caused the problem, which is true, and why are you asking us to do anything? You should solve it. And nothing much happened. Paris is the first occasion that all the major developing countries, India included, actually took on some form of obligation to reduce emissions. But the bad news is that what has been agreed is very far from solving the problem. I mean, first, of course, the commitments are not enforceable. There are no penalties if you don't agree to, you don't do what you agreed to. But, you know, more important, the commitments are just not enough. If all the countries do everything that they've promised, then the best we can say is that we are on track to stabilize temperatures at 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, whereas the target was to do better than 2 degrees, and many, many people feel that even that involves excessive high costs, and we ought to be trying to do it at 1.5. So Paris is not even in no way likely to get us there, but it's a step. There's going to be another conference 5 years later. We're going to review progress. So the hope is that now that all countries have agreed to do something, that in due course, what needs to be done will be strengthened even further. And this is going to require action, more action on the part of industrialized countries and more action on the part of the developing countries. Now, the industrialized countries will have to commit to a faster reduction in their own emissions. You know, speaking for the developing countries, I do want to point out that there is a very funny asymmetry in the way this issue is presented, because the developing countries are committing to reductions, but they somehow manage to turn the tables on the developing countries and say, when are you going to do reductions? Whereas actually, the name of the game was that the developing countries have to be allowed an increase in their emissions rate and then perhaps peak and then go down, whereas the developing countries have to go down straight away. So the industrialized countries have to commit to faster reduction. They also have to commit to providing appropriate financial support to help the developing countries do what is necessary. I'll come to the issue of the additional costs that are involved, which justify this. The developing countries have to do more to contain the growth of their emissions consistent with growth and poverty reduction, and ultimately to reduce the level to fit the global carbon budget. Now, there is no agreement yet on what is an equitable distribution of burden to achieve this end result. So that just tells you how much more needs to be done. Oops. What we've done here is we're assuming that future negotiations will produce an environment that will be conducive to developing countries agreeing to do more and looking for ways to do it. And in that context, we zero in on India, asking the question, can India do better than business as usual? So essentially, we explore two alternatives, the business as usual, as well as a low carbon. We do it on the basis of a calculator, the RESS, that means India Energy Security Scenarios V2, recently published by the Niti Aayog. So this is a government tool which has been made public, is available on the web, and it puts in a large number of alternative assumptions. So the assumptions we have used are not outside the ballpark of what the successor institution to the Planning Commission has put forward as things that could happen. And the big difference between this and an economic model is that the growth rate is exogenous. So in a way, you postulate a growth rate knowing that there are many policy implications of achieving that growth rate, and you have to assume that those have been calculated and you'll go and do what is necessary to achieve that. But then look at a whole lot of options on the energy side to see whether you can generate a better or a worse trajectory in terms of energy and emissions. And the difference between the usual economic model, the economic model will take a parameter like whatever the energy elasticity with respect to GDP, and will say, well, this could be reduced at a certain rate. But you know, these are constructs. They're not things that engineers understand. This thing is actually based on very, very specific assumptions, such as what's the percentage of public of passenger transport that could move from private to public over a 20-year period, as worked out by the kind of people who specialize in the sector? Or what's the likely reduction in energy per unit of output in the major energy-using industries, steel, cement, etc., looking at benchmarks across the world and likely improvements in technology? What's the number of buildings that could become energy efficient? What could be happening to air conditioning to make it more energy efficient? That sort of thing. So it's very detailed, and it's grounded in the sort of stuff that engineers do in order to identify what is possible. We don't look at the emissions that result from changes in land use, etc. So we're just looking at energy in this context. Now, in both the business as usual and the low carbon scenario, the rate of growth has been exogenously fixed at an average of 7.4% per annum. This is actually quite high. And Nick and I have discussed that maybe in a later version of the paper, we should moderate it, because the average over such a long period, admittedly India is at an early stage in terms of per capita income, but it's quite possible that if India grows at 8% or so for another 10 or 15 years, it might be forced to slow down thereafter. So whether 7.4 is correct or not, I'm aware that it probably shaded on the optimistic side. It doesn't alter the basic nature of the argument that will follow. Well, the growth rate leads to all kinds of structural changes, like the rate of urbanization, et cetera, the growth of demand per capita passenger transport, per capita residential space, and so on. And this is then used by the calculator, along with assumptions about energy, to tell us what's going to happen to energy use. So on the demand side, the calculator identifies this group of sectors. And actually, transport is both passenger and freight separately, and then works out in the year 2047, based on what we think are likely to be the energy efficiency improvements in a business as usual basis. And there are some improvements, but they're not humongously huge. What is going to be the total final demand for energy? And I think, as you can see from this table, that, you know, almost 93% of the energy use in the final year actually comes from these three areas: transport, buildings, and industry. Now, buildings, of course, includes all of services, because services take place in buildings. So there's a large part of the economy. These sectors have been added in the calculator, but they don't actually add up to such a huge amount of energy use. And what it shows is that from a base level of 423 million tons of oil equivalent, the total energy demand increases four times. But that's an annual growth rate of only 4.2% per year, as you can see there, whereas the GDP growth rate is 7.4%. So in fact, the energy elasticity of GDP is approximately, or with respect to GDP, is approximately 0.53, which is much better than in the previous decades, which was 0.63 and 0.72. So the business as usual doesn't mean no improvement in energy efficiency. It does mean some improvement in energy efficiency. On the supply side, the principal point, I mean, we having got the demand side, this thing models what are the different sources of primary energy that will generate the demand. Now, I should point out that electricity is not a primary energy source. Some of the primary sources go into electricity, which then goes into the GDP. So that's not modeled here. But essentially, the thing to note is that in the BAU, what we're seeing is, if you look at the energy percentage coming from coal in the base year, it's 2012, it's 46.3. In 2047, it's 47.8. But actually a slight increase in the coal dependence on primary energy. A slight increase also in oil. Decrease in gas, mainly because it's expected that domestic gas production prospects are not all that good. A fairly large increase in solar, but it's from such small levels that it doesn't add up to very much. An increase in nuclear, and actually a decline in hydro. And that's because the available sites where hydropower can be generated are limited. So this is the structural change. And from an emissions point of view, the main point is that whereas 46.3% of total energy came from coal in the base year, in the business as usual, 47.8% will be coming from coal. Breaking away from primary energy, it's interesting to look at what's happening to electricity generation. Here, the dependence on coal for generating electricity goes down. So instead of 66%, it goes down to 58%. In the case of gas, it goes down significantly. In the case of nuclear, it goes up a little. In the case of hydro, it goes down quite a bit, simply because there aren't enough sites that will generate hydropower, going down from 13% to 5%. And in the case of solar, there's a big increase. So the percent of electricity coming from solar and wind shows a big increase. But remember that electricity in the total energy mix in India is actually quite low. So whereas in the base year, electricity was 15% of total energy, in the business as usual, in the terminal year, it increases only to 18.6%. So you've got electricity less important than it might be in a more advanced country, but within the electricity, you're getting a decline in dependence on coal and, of course, an increase in dependence on renewable energy. What does this mean for import dependence? Actually, not very good things. In the case of coal, import depends sustainable. And what we're looking at is a low-carbon trajectory possible. Now, what this does is it explores the scope for doing better than the business as usual. And the key elements are brought out in this identity. I mean, the objective from the point of view of sustainability has to be to reduce emissions. The objective from the point of view of welfare and poverty reduction and all the rest of it is to increase GDP. So clearly, you want a reduction in the ratio of emissions to GDP. Nobody's really interested in reducing GDP if the ratio of emissions to GDP can be dropped sufficiently. Now that, by this identity, is just a product of these two terms. Energy divided by GDP multiplied by emissions divided by energy. So the energy cancels out, and this becomes just emissions divided by GDP. What you get, if you follow that, the IESS V2 allows us to make energy efficiency choices in 17 different areas of energy demand. So for example, I mentioned earlier passenger transport. You can make some assumptions about how much public transport versus private. You can make assumptions about how urban planning will reduce the need for transportation within cities. You can make assumptions about the penetration of electric vehicles over this long period, which would reduce the demand for gasoline. Similarly, with freight transport, development of logistic corridors shift from road to rail. Now, behind these parameters are a whole lot of facilitating infrastructure investments and policy changes, et cetera, that are needed. But this sort of focuses attention on what needs to be done. Similarly, in the case of buildings, residential buildings, energy-efficient insulation and energy-efficient household appliances. In the case of commercial buildings, again, energy-efficient insulation, energy-efficient commercial appliances, e.g., for example, AC systems. And one of the important things about India is that, you know, it has been repeated many times, that if India has the growth rate that we are hoping it will have, then almost 70% of the commercial buildings that would be needed to be in place by 2047 have yet to be built. So there's a great leapfrogging possibility. We're not dealing with too much legacy infrastructure. A lot of the new stuff still has to come. Of course, industry is a big user. In agriculture, there's the use of electricity in pumps, also fossil fuel in tractors, and then cooking and telecommunication. They're not very important, but they're part of the calculator. Along with these demand-side interventions, there are a lot of supply-side options. These were essentially, one is the introduction of superthermal technology for generating electricity from coal. I mean, this increases the efficiency of the process and use much less coal for the same amount of electricity. Improvements in grid management, which would reduce transmission and distribution losses. Now, some of these transmission and distribution losses are just theft. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the things that are genuine technical losses, which are actually high and can be reduced in various ways. Deployment of bioenergy and, of course, deployment of solar energy, both on utility scale and distributed. Now, these actions are over and above those already built into the BAU, which includes quite a big build-up of solar capacity. So what does this add up to? Well, what we have here is the comparison between the BAU scenario, which is here, for 2047, and the low-carbon scenario. Essentially, in terms of million tons of oil equivalent, we can bring about a 36% reduction in the total energy demand in the system as a cumulative result of all those 17 interventions plus the supply side intervention. So the total demand goes down from, this is for the same GDP, goes down from 1704 to 1085. On the supply side, what does it mean? Well, it's interesting because in electricity generation, the total generation of electricity is 1147 over there. It's only slightly higher than in the business as usual, okay? But the share of electricity in total energy is much larger. It was 18% and now it's 24.8. That's because the total demand for energy has gone down. And within electricity, there's a big change, for example, in the share of coal. Instead of 44% in instead of the earlier number
66
was about 40 something percent, it's now down to
23%. 66% is 2012.
Yeah, no, but I was thinking of what it was in the BAU. I should have put it here, but it goes back. Let me
look at that actually. Thank you.
Yeah, in the business as usual, coal dependence was 58%. So it had gone down from 66 only to 58. But in the low carbon, it goes down to 23%. So that's a very big change. And of course, in solar and wind, there are big increases compared to the business as usual. And the net result of all this is essentially here, where the total emissions in the business as usual were 10,027. As a result of these demand-side actions and these supply-side actions, the total emissions get reduced from 10,027 to 5,608. And the per capita emissions, which were 5.9, declined to 3.3. That's still high, given the global target, but it's an indication of how much is actually possible. And our view is that, you know, the likelihood that technology will move rapidly, more rapidly than we have assumed, is much greater if the industrialized countries take on the task of bringing down their own emissions faster than they are currently wanting to do. And that's a key, because what happens in the industrialized world will drive the technology. And if more is done in the industrialized world, it'll become easier for the developing world to actually improve on its own performance. So here is the picture. A graphic presentation of what happens to GHG emissions in the low carbon scenario versus the business as usual. In business as usual, it goes up to 10,027, and it goes up pretty steadily with some deceleration, but there's no peaking before 2047. But in the low carbon scenario, the total GHG emissions peak at 2042, and then they go down. So until now, the government of India has not actually addressed this issue in any of its INDCs. But this is looking ahead, that the options identified in the calculator produced by the Niti Aayog, I mean, this is not our set of assumptions. This is just the most optimistic outcome from the assumptions that the Niti Aayog people have themselves put in. You can have a peak and then it kind of goes down. So an obvious question to ask is, how does this compare with China? And we know that in China's case, they have promised a peaking. And there are different views on the peaking. I think the Chinese have said they want to do it before 2030. Nick and his colleagues have actually said they may actually be able to do it around 2035. But these are emissions per capita for China. And let's say if you take the target of 2030, not 2047, because all the INDCs are about 2030, you could have Chinese emissions at somewhere between 9.2 or 10 tons per capita in 2030. Using the Indian metric, under the BAU, it would be 3.8 tons. Under the low carbon, it would become 3 tons. This is 2030. Obviously, later on, the numbers change. Now, if the low carbon scenario is followed, then we can estimate that India will peak around 2042, China before at 2030 or before, as Nick and his colleagues say, 2025. An important point is that China will peak GHG emissions at a point when its per capita income is twice that of India's when it will peak. So in other words, according to this low carbon scenario, the peaking point for India will occur in temporal time later than China, but in development time earlier, in the sense that it will be peaking at lower levels of per capita income. And one reason for that, of course, is the possibility of leapfrogging technology and being able to do things, the advantage of the late starter. this leaves us, it would be wrong to conclude that therefore everything is hunky-dory. And we've done a little calculation here. If China and India both have per capita GHG emissions of approximately 5 tons per capita by 2040. These are very rough numbers. This would generate total emissions of 15 billion tons of CO2 equivalent between India and China. Now, we know that the global carbon budget by 2050 is only 20 billion CO2 equivalent, which means that even on these optimistic assumptions, it amounts to India and China claiming 75% of the global carbon budget by themselves. I mean, this is simply to show that even if India does all these things, and maybe China does even more than what they've so far promised, to say that we've solved the global warming problem, I mean, would be a gross exaggeration. It just means that things are possible and you've got to do a lot more. And just remember that if you want a 2 degrees centigrade path, in other words, stabilizing global temperatures at 2 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial level, you need zero net global emissions, zero, in the second half of this century. If you want to stabilize at 1.5 degrees centigrade, which some of the small island countries actually feel is essential if they're to survive, then the zero carbon budget for the world as a whole has to be reached somewhere around mid-century. Now, I'm saying this not to rubbish what's being attempted, but simply to indicate that if we are serious about these targets, we should applaud the fact that the first step has been taken. But you know, as Chairman Mao used to say, the longest journey begins with the first step, but it doesn't end there. A lot of other steps that will have to be taken. And these are not steps that only the developing countries should be expected to take. That's very critical. Because too often in the way the debate is put forward, it's presented as if the solution lies in the hands of the developing countries alone. That's actually not true. It lies in the hands of everybody. A couple more points. One is that, you know, well, I've made the point about energy security, but, you know, there are reasons why developing countries need to do more than might otherwise seem, unconnected with global impact on the climate. I mean, for example, one of them is water. Coal uses between 14,000 and 28,000 liters per 1,000 kilowatt hours, whereas solar PV uses 0.1 liter per 1,000 kilowatt hours. So if water is a constraint, and we know that water is a constraint, certainly in India water is a constraint, in many parts of India it's a very serious constraint, then the idea of continually building coal-based generation capacity doesn't make any sense. And this needs to be factored into the planning of all countries. Because there's a serious problem here that, you know, if you want to transit to a low-carbon, low-water-using technology, you want to avoid building up assets which commit you to all this. Because energy assets last for 30 years. So whatever you build today is going to be on the ground running for 30 years, or you'll have to treat it as a stranded asset which involves a huge capital cost. You know, my view is this is not adequately factored into the public debate, certainly not in India, and I think not in most developing countries either. So I think we need to keep this in mind in chalking up what is actually possible. So the next question, I think I need to stop in 7 minutes, right?
It's okay.
The next question is, does it cost something? Well, the short answer is yes, it's not free. And here is one estimate, again, based on the Niti Aayog numbers, which indicates what is the ratio of capital investments to GDP additional between the low carbon and the business as usual. And as you can see, in the initial years, you need about 3% of GDP more to move on to the low carbon scenario, and that gap reduces over time because capital costs in the low carbon technologies will go down. There is a saving in fuel costs. Because in the case of the low-carbon technologies, fuel costs as a percent of total costs are likely to increase, whereas in the low-carbon technology, total fuel costs as a percent of total costs of generating energy actually will decline. Now, we've done a lot of calculations about discounting and so forth. That's all interesting, but I don't want to go into that. It simply tells you that there are savings, but there are costs, and in the initial period, there's no question that there are costs. And this is relevant because developing countries that have to incur this cost either are going to accept a much lower growth rate because all this money is going to come from other investment, or there has to be some mechanism that will incentivize money to go into this area, and that's where the global community could do a lot. I think that when we talk about costs, there's one very important factor which, again, I think is not adequately appreciated in the developing world, and that is that the resistance to using, the resistance to adopting higher cost methods of saving carbon come from the belief that, you know, if we do this, the benefits won't accrue to us. And that's true insofar as the benefits consist of lower GHG emissions for the world as a whole, because it's the total GHG emissions that determine total impact on climate. So what you do, the benefit goes to everyone. Just as what everyone else does, the benefit comes to you also. And the argument there is that unless there's an international agreement to do enough, along with an agreement on a rational, equitable distribution of burden, nothing will be done. But you know, one factor that has not been allowed for is that taking steps to move towards a low-carbon economy, there are a lot of co-benefits. And those co-benefits are not external, they're internal to the economy actually taking those steps. One of them clearly is high levels of pollution costs, which in many contexts are really quite high. Some people, maybe Nick would like to elaborate on this later, but certainly many people internationally have made estimates of what are the pollution costs in terms of percentages of GDP. One calculation I've seen suggests that if you calculate the costs of pollution, not the cost of global warming, but just the cost of local pollution, local means within the country, and you impose a carbon tax, which would effectively internalize that cost, then the price of coal would rise to three times the present level. And of course, if you impose such a tax, the government would get that money, use of coal would become expensive, coal-based electricity would become expensive, and the government would be able to use that money to subsidize other things. It's a huge change, but you're talking about, you're talking about trebling the price of coal in order to bring about a true internalization of the pollution costs of using coal. Not easy to do. I mean, politicians in any country hate withdrawing subsidies, hate raising prices, but yet if you want to internalize these costs somehow or the other, that problem has to be taken care of. Of course, the other benefit is that if you push for a shift to a low-carbon technology, the development of the technology will lead to further benefits which we're not actually able to estimate right now. And it's quite possible that if the system is lucky, that the push in a particular direction will actually lead to surprising gains in technology. Depends on whether you're a technology pessimist or a technology optimist. So I think on the whole, these factors can be used to argue in developing countries that we ought to take more interest in bringing about the switch from a high carbon to a low carbon trajectory. And in fact, countries are doing that. I mean, India, for example, big thrust now in improving, increasing the volume of capacity for solar and wind-based electricity. That's going to cost money. And I mean, we haven't actually worked out who's going to pay for that. I mean, it could be done, for example, in many ways, and I'll come to that in a second, such as, for example, forcing distribution companies to buy a certain percentage of the electricity that they have to buy from renewable sources, or trading in renewable certificates, so you buy it from someone else who's actually doing the right kind of electricity generation. So this is the last part of the presentation, and that is, I think so far what I've argued is that we need to do more, And the numbers that are built into the Niti Aayog calculator do suggest that quite a bit can be done. That's probably not going to be enough to achieve the objectives of climate change, but it'll go quite a long way. And as the process begins, technology might become a lot better. So now the question is, what do you do in order to bring about that change? Well, I think it's clear that it requires a number of improvements, behavior changes, and restructuring of incentives in the energy-using sectors. There's no single instrument that can be used to trigger the change. I mean, I talked about 17 different areas of demand, different choices. Each one of those requires multiple levels of intervention. And many of these interventions are complementary to each other. Let's give some examples. Energy pricing and taxes, which means removing subsidies, pollution and carbon pricing, and use of tax for that purpose. This is clearly one of the most obvious, it's what the economists would think of first. It's also one of the most difficult things to do. But if we are going to bring about such a huge change, I mean, some progress along these lines is essential. And here is where, in my view, the industrialized countries can give the biggest lead. Because, you know, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to persuade developing countries to put in carbon pricing and carbon taxation if the developed countries aren't doing it, and it's a global problem. And they're actually generating much more emissions than the developing world is. So a sensible move towards carbon pricing in industrialized countries would start the debate in developing countries that maybe we should do the same thing. We are actually very far from that. As you all know, I mean, the US's INDC commitments were critically dependent on an initiative of the US administration, a very good initiative actually, to reduce the carbon emissions from existing coal-based power plants. That has been struck down by the courts. Somebody took matter to court. Courts have said you can't do this, so we don't quite know what's going to happen in that area. So just an example that, you know, these are difficult things, but it's important that progress is made sooner rather than later. Second, you can use regulation and standards to complement price behavior. I mean, you could, for example, lay down certain standards of fuel efficiency, certain standards for automotive fuels, certain standards of energy efficiency, all kinds of electrical appliances, and that could be done by fiat, which would more or less force people to move from energy inefficient appliances to more energy efficient appliances. You know, in developing countries, this very often runs into the problem that it's perceived as being biased in favor of the more modern enterprises because they're the ones that are most able to implement these measures. So that's a conflict that is there. But if the longer term objective is to do something on energy, we'll have to face that conflict. An important issue here is that different policies lie in the domain of different governments. I mean, in India, there's the central government, the state government, there's local governments. So, you know, energy policy for petroleum and coal is in the hands of the central government. But how to price electricity is in the hands of state governments. What to do about public transport tends to be in the hands of local governments. But they don't have the money to bring about the change. So in our main paper, we have a huge table which sort of lists how in each of these areas there are multiple policies, and each of these policies is the domain of different governments. So to get a credible combined impact on the policy front actually requires coordination amongst different levels of government, which makes it very difficult. Very important that whatever the policy is, it should be clear and credible for investors. You can't have a situation where every 2 years somebody comes up with a bright idea and changes the incentive structure. You know, I mean, if you're giving incentives for a particular kind of, say, renewable energy, and somebody's invested for a 20-year period on the strength of those signals, then it becomes important that whatever changes you make for the future, the changes which were put in place to incentivize that particular investment should not change. Unless that is assured, it's very unlikely that you get any private investment getting into this area. And the truth is, given fiscal constraints, if you can't get the private investment into many of these areas, you're just not going to get investment at all. So I think that's another area where we need to worry about. And finally, of course, all policy changes involve social impact. And it's extremely important that the implications of these policy changes be discussed and known so that you can bring more and more stakeholders on board. So that, I think, is a five-point summary, that the business-as-usual scenario will lead to an environmentally unsustainable growth path for India and the world. The low-carbon scenario suggests that India does have options available that can make major improvements to the GHG emissions trajectory and foster strong and high-quality development. The majority of GHG emissions can come from selected sectors, industry, transportation, and use in buildings. There should be increased focus on these sectors to support the transition. By the way, I should have highlighted in the presentation that, you know, when you look at the demand and the supply side, I don't know if I did highlight it, but in the Indian case, 86% of the reduction in GHG emissions comes from the demand side, and only 14% comes from the supply side. You know, in the public imagination, renewable energy is the new kid on the block, and everybody's focusing on that. But in India, most of the solution is going to come from choices that increase the energy efficiency or reduce the energy requirement for a given level of GDP. There's no single intervention that can be used. We need a combination of price and regulatory-based measures and well-structured public investments in energy system, transport system, and urban planning and infrastructure to support the low-carbon scenario. Reduced pollution and increased energy security provided through the low-carbon scenario are strong co-benefits. But finally, global action will be important in encouraging developing countries to act. I think that's the last slide. Thank
Good.
You. Supplement.
Thank you, Montek. And it was very nice to see something that we bashed out over a period of time in different places made to sound so coherent and clear and structured and as if it was written in a logical steps all the way from the beginning. But you have to lift out the logic, and I thought you did that beautifully. Let me just make a very few points of an entirely different nature, one from the other. The first is that there are four institutions involved in this work. There's ICRIA in India. We have the chair, Isha Ahluwalia, of ICRIA with us. I'm proud to be a member of the board of ICRIA, which is one of the top 20 think tanks in the world. And the Grantham Institute at London School of Economics, alongside the ESRC-sponsored institute, which is on it's essentially a center called the ESRC Center on climate economics and policy, and the India Observatory, which I'm the director, and the co-director is Ruth Katamuri. So four outfits involved. The second question I want to draw attention to is the curiousness that might appear from some of these dates. We concentrated on 2030 and 2047. The reason we concentrated on 2030 for some of our observations was that that's the period of the INDCs, the intended nationally determined contributions, the targets that were set down in Paris. They were set for 2030, not for periods after 2030, although everybody knows that action after 2030 is extremely important. The targets for the numbers in Paris, or the target date, the numbers in Paris was 2030. 2047, as you all know, is the 100th anniversary of Indian independence. It sounds much more interesting than 2050. But that's why we've chosen 2047. The next point, and these are, as I said, of very different nature, people sometimes say, well, goodness me, we've got to go to zero net. How on earth do we go to zero net? The reason we say zero net is stabilization. Even if, God forbid, it was at 5 degrees centigrade, stabilization of temperature requires zero net. In other words, sinks and sources balance each other out. all the time we're above zero net, the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere rise, the greenhouse effect intensifies and temperatures go up. So zero net is not something associated with having a particular target. It's something associated with having any target, and that means zero net. What's more interesting, because that's just, you know, the basic physics, but what's interesting is the tougher the target, the earlier you are at zero net. And if you're going to get anywhere near holding to 2 degrees, you've got to go zero net well before the end of the century. And if you want to do 1.5 degrees, you've got to go zero net very soon, by mid-century or the 100th anniversary of independence. This is of the world, right? Zero net for the world. If you've got zero net for the world, wherever you've got a positive, you've got to have a negative. So we're going to have to get clever at negative as well as bringing down the positive. So what I want to do, what I've said in this remarks about zero net has got nothing to do with economics, simple physics. Zero net, if you're to stabilize at whatever level you happen to stabilize, and the more ambitious the temperature reduction, the earlier you go to zero net. Next, I haven't got many more, but next on the cost of coal. Coal is not cheap. We have a paper with that title which we'll be releasing in a couple of weeks. But let me give you a little bit of mental arithmetic. Take an imaginary country with 1 billion people with income per capita $10,000. I'm deliberately using round numbers. But I mean, call it China. I mean, a country with 1 billion people, $10,000 income per capita, but or not, call it something else, but an abstract country, $10,000 per capita, 1 billion people. Suppose that air pollution kills 1 million people a year, probably more in China, roughly 4,000 a day. Well, that's more than a million a year. But suppose, I've got all ones here to keep it all simple. So 1 million deaths a year, 1 billion people, $10,000 per capita. The normal, and here I'm getting a bit vulgar as opposed to simple, I'm going from simple to vulgar. Let's suppose that a cost of a life is 100 times GDP per capita. That's pretty standard in these kinds of calculations of, do you invest in a transport project that reduces accidents and reduces deaths? What do you put into health services in order to reduce deaths? 100 times income per capita is pretty standard. It's quite interesting because people in different countries have done it in different ways, but that's ballpark. So if you've got $10,000 per capita, and you've got 1 million deaths, 10,000 times 1 million is the cost per year of, sorry, let me start again. 1 million deaths a year. 10 times, hang on, let me start again. It's the end of the day, but it's actually very easy. We've agreed that there are 1 million deaths a year. That's my hypothesis. And I've also hypothesized that the cost of a death is 10 times GDP per capita. GDP per capita is 10,000. So the cost of a life is 1 million. And 1 million times 1 million is 1 trillion. Okay? Sorry about the tiredness. But a life is 1 million. You've got 1 million deaths. 1 million times 1 million is 1 trillion is the cost. This country, by assumption, has $10,000 per capita and 1 billion people. So GDP is 10 trillion. Yeah? So the cost of these deaths, 1 million times dollars times 1 million deaths a year, is 1 trillion. than GDP per capita is 10 trillion. That's costing you 10% of GDP. Now, you can fiddle around with the numbers, and you might get 5% of GDP or 15% of GDP. That's not my point. My point is these numbers are really big, and it's not all the air pollution is down to burning fossil fuels, but a big chunk of it, a very big chunk of it, is down to burning fossil fuels. So the point I'm making here is that it's very powerful. A corresponding calculation, coal costs $50 a ton. Depends on the coal, but coal costs $50 a ton. You burn a ton of coal, and it goes to 2 tons CO2, roughly speaking. Yeah, it depends on the carbon content of the coal, but ballpark. You've got a price of carbon of $35 per ton of CO2, which is the US standard price, very much on the low side, in my view. 2 times 35 is 70, so the cost of your ton of coal has gone up from 120, gone up to 120, 50 plus 70. Now, if you look at the pollution costs, and I've just shown how big they are just now, and the IMF's done some very good work on that, you might be adding another 150. So you might, 150 on top of 120 is 270. That $50 a ton of coal has gone to 270. Even if you strip out the carbon stuff, because that's kind of world, and you say, well, just add on the cost local. Well, to the 50, we've added on 150. That $50 a ton of coal is 200. The only way you can wriggle out of that is to say that, well, actually, cost of a life is negligible. We might, you know, kill a few more, but, you know, we've produced some more electricities. If that's your argument, well, please make it explicit. Yeah? And, of course, people don't. They just say coal's cheap. Coal's not cheap. Coal's extremely expensive. And that's not mostly the carbon story. It's mostly the pollution story. Now, that was my mental arithmetic on the cost of coal. But I hope it's enough to say that this is a very, very big issue on the cost of coal. You can't park it on one side, given how big those numbers are. The fifth remark I want to make is that technological change is just amazing. And we finished the Stern review about 10 years ago now. The cost of a solar panel has come down by a factor of 10, 90% reduction in that time, with very little technical progress, mostly been economies of scale, some sort of learning by doing on the job. We've got a lot of technical progress to come, just in solar. It's going to come, and we can see where it's coming from. If you can reduce the cost of carbon fiber, say, from $2,000 a ton to $500 a ton, and you may well, actually, you replace a load of the world's steel by carbon fiber, and you lock that carbon fiber in forever. So and I'm going tomorrow to Anand Mahindra's launch of his electric car here in London, a really cost-competitive, smaller electric car. So if you can't afford a Tesla, then buy a Mahindra electric car. You know, I've given very different examples, you know, solar, carbon fiber replacing steel, electric cars. Who'd thought 10 years ago that all the major manufacturers would be making electric cars? I was present when the Prime Minister of China told the head of the Ford Motor Company a month ago that the era of the sedan in China has got 5 or 10 years to run. By that he meant the standard car. I mean, call it a Mondeo if you like. And he says 5 or 10 years. He said, if you don't change what you make, actually, there are 3 or 4 Chinese firms that are moving very rapidly in this direction. So I've become a technological optimist, but what I'm less optimistic about is whether we'll have the good sense to put the policies in place to really put all this stuff into practice. That's endogenous. That's why you come to the London School of Economics. I mean, it's to try to make policy happen more quickly than it otherwise would. But the technological side of the story is changing so much faster than any of us thought it could 10 years ago. So we've made some fairly grand assumptions here in our low-carbon story about how strong action could be. But we haven't made grand assumptions, really, Montek, about the technology, at least not so grand. I mean, some, of course. So, you know, when we're thinking of those things, it may be that we could go faster. And what Montek set out so clearly is that we really have to go. We really have to go faster. So the final point of all is, as somebody who's been going to India for more than 40 years, the traction in this kind of argument that we've seen over the last year or two has dramatically changed. The discussion in this kind of paper we had when we presented it at ICRIA, or an ICRIA-organized event on February the 1st in India, was one about the detail, what could be done, how it's done. It wasn't prefixed by, it's you dirty people from the rich countries that filled up the atmosphere and now you're asking us to grow more slowly. That's not a bad argument, actually. But it has a lot in it. But things have changed. People have realized that we have to get on with it. And I think even more deeply, and this is my last point, I think people around the world are understanding that actually combining growth and climate responsibility is possible. And it's more than possible. It's actually to go down a path that's extremely attractive and much more attractive than the alternative. So that's what I wanted to add. But thank you again, Montek, for such a clear and strong exposition.